Coming to you from Toronto, Canada, this is Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to this show.
This is John Meadows.
This is Mike Bataxi.
This is Donna Bataxi.
And I'm Alex Lokes, and welcome to Classic Camera Revival live from the Meadows Studio in lovely Toronto, Canada for January 2015.
Yay!
Hurrah! Hurrah! Says everyone.
Hey guys, and welcome, welcome. Hopefully we have some listeners out there at the trouble of starting a new podcast. And this is Classic Camera Revival, the show about classic camera gear. We're just a group of passionate film photographers who just want to share our experience using gear, maybe give you some ideas of what you want to get into. So today's topic is workhorse cameras. So let's start here with Mike and his absolutely gorgeous Canon T90.
Yep, this wonderful little, although a lot of people will tell me it's not so little, especially when I'm comparing it to some of the other cameras on the table here. This camera, I'm only calling it little when I'm comparing it to things like the Canon EOS 1V, which was a little bit bigger camera or medium format. Now, this camera here, it's a plastic body. Now, I know that automatically a lot of people are going boo to a plastic body, but the fact is it makes it light. Now, when it comes to light, if you're using a camera that you want to use as a workhorse, that means it's going to be in your hand often. It's going to be in your hand for a long time, and lightweight is a good thing. The other thing is, Canon brought in a industrial designer, Luigi Colani, who actually came up with the design for the Canon T90. Canon wanted to move away from their boxier system, such like the Canon A1, or when they went into the T-series, they kind of tried to make it a little more modern, but it was still a boxy design. Well, enter the T90 in 1986, and suddenly it was smooth lines. It was all curves. I mean, you could almost imagine that for an industrial designer, you'd almost expect them to be more like a fashion designer, considering smooth lines, curves, stuff like that. It's almost like talking about models on a runway. But one of the things that I really like about this is the hand grip. Just that one item alone, you can hold this camera one-handed up to your eye. I mean, sure, you have to have your other hand because it is not an autofocus camera, which we'll get into that in a few minutes. But you hold it one-handed, and if you're doing hyperfocal lengths such as doing street photography, a lot of people love doing that with a rangefinder. This, do it one-handed, hold it up to your eye, take the shot, back down again. You don't miss a beat. The button for taking the exposure, it's right there. The other thing is, when it was released, is Canon also had the option that you could have it modified, and there is the hardware actually inside the camera to do it, is put a vertical release on it. So when you're in portrait length or portrait orientation on the camera, you could also have the release. You can, if I'm showing around the round table here, there's a small cutaway on the battery bay at the bottom. And that little cutaway, you can see that would be perfect spot for the release on the bottom. Now, of course, mine didn't get that modification, so I don't have it. The other modification that Canon did, which I was surprised to see, because I have seen cameras out there, which apparently, yes, they are rare, they put a PC sync port, and that is one of the things that this camera does not have. They would mount it actually right on the prism housing, right to the left, looking at it from back to front. It would be on the left side of the prism housing. They would put a PC sync port. So it's fairly lightweight. It's not a compact camera by any means. And, it's designed as a professional level. Now, did it ever reach the professional market? I'd probably say not 100% because of the Canon F1, which really dominated the market, especially since when you compare it to a Nikon, it was the only real other competitor against Nikon. now a lot of other people that are running Pentax models and Olympus are probably now wanting to shoot me for saying that, but I mean, when it comes down to it, Canon and Nikon, there's a reason why they were number one in the market. They fought each other constantly, yeah. And their camera systems were designed in competition to each other, and everybody knows competition is good because their cameras got better and better and better as time went on. So we take the T90. It's now basically an automatic camera. It has every single override you can imagine. It's got program mode. It's got smart program shift, manual mode, aperture priority, shutter priority. It does everything you want. You can change the drive from single shot to high for taking multiple exposures. So, I mean, you just hold down the shutter and it's click, 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 click. It's really, really good. But, I mean, let's face it. How many people are really out there shooting that speed now using film when digital is kind of taking over that aspect of spray and pray. Yep.
Spray and pray.
Yes, we said it and we're not ashamed.
Yeah. Well, so a lot of time I have this actually set to low so that it'll take roughly 2 frames per second, but that's just because I prefer it that way, so it winds onto the next frame really quickly. But I have set it to single many times over, so there's been many times where I've held the shutter a little bit too long and I didn't realize that it was set to 1/60th or faster, and it didn't give me enough time to take away my finger fast enough, and all of a sudden I'm now 4 frames in. Well, now the camera itself is just, it's really smooth design, and I don't know, I something about it, I just really like it, and the shutter sound, it is just awesome. I mean, you can't get a better sound than that. Just fantastic.
Nice.
So the other thing is, as I was mentioning about autofocus. Now, when we look at this camera, and yes, it came out in 86. Sadly, it was really short-lived, unlike their predecessor models, such as the T50, T70, and the A-series. The reason it was short-lived is in 86... there was a camera expo that came out, and one of the cameras that Canon introduced in 86, although it wasn't released in 86, that came next year, was the EOS 650. Now, the EOS line of camera, now this is where Canon started to separate themselves from the rest. Now, a lot of other manufacturers maintained aperture rings on the body or on the lens itself, which to this day, I still love aperture rings. They're fantastic, but that's another story. Just less dials. And in 87 is the EOS 650 came out, and a lot of people got really upset with Canon, and this actually changed, really, really changed the game for them. They suddenly went from basically a plastic but heavy body. They went to the 650 for autofocus. It just changed everything. And Canon has never looked back. And honestly, I say good on them. For one thing, it's made the FD mount glass a heck of a lot cheaper because, let's face it, orphan glass, man, in today's terms, that means savings in your pocket.
Yep.
And when Canon went the EOS line, the EF model, a lot of pro photographers, yes, they did get upset with Canon. A lot of them did drop their line and switch to Nikon. And all this pro glass suddenly hit the market, and it was going for dirt cheap because the market got flooded. Another thing is backwards compatibility. We'll discuss a little bit further with other cameras with backwards compatibility, but the Canon, sadly, EF mount will not mount. I don't know how many times I've tried putting lenses up for sale, and I constantly get comments back, will this lens mount on my new digital camera? No, it will not mount. For one, it uses a different register. It is a lot closer to the film plane. EF uses a further register, so you need corrective optics. I mean, if you want to have a great macro lens, go for it. Get the adapter, mount it up. Everybody knows how great the corrective optics are. Or let me rephrase that. Not.
Sarcasm alert.
it For macro, fantastic. As I've told my colleagues before, I did a great shot of a bumblebee, or not a bumblebee, a carpenter bee. There was a bench that was infested with them. And strangely enough, everybody's staring at me like I'm like some person that's escaped. Needless to say, I'm literally, it looks like I'm chasing around a carpenter bee with my digital camera with a 24 millimeter FD lens mounted on it, but without the corrective optics. Now it's a killer macro lens. And sure enough, I took about 40 or 50 shots of this bee, but one of them, and this is where the whole spray and pray comes in, one of them was just spectacular. It was maybe about 2 inches, 3 inches from the bee in flight, and I just caught the perfect capture of it. Just phenomenal. Really? And yes, I have to admit it. Yes, I did chimp the shot. And in all honesty, it was definitely worth it. 100%.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Mike.
You're welcome.
Okay, so next up, we're going to go a bit bigger in size, and we're going to go with John Meadows and his Mamiya 645 series.
Man, that is a really beautiful camera.
It is.
Yeah, the specific model I have in my hands is the 645 Pro TL, but I'm going to go back in time a bit and just talk overall. The Mamiya 645 series is named after the size negative. It uses 120 film. But the negative size, instead of being 6 by 6 centimeters squared, like on a Hasselblad, for example, it is 6 centimeters by 4.5 centimeters. So you get about 15, 16 shots a roll, depending on the manufacturer. The negative size is about 2.5 times the size of 35 millimeter. And that gets you a lot of flexibility. For example, you can, because you don't have to magnify the negative as much when you're either printing in a darkroom or scanning, on a scanner, you can use faster film like the Delta 3200, or you can use Tri-X and push it in low light situations, and grain will not be as much of an issue. I've also found that on scanners that are, let's say, the more low-end scanners, they're not forced to work as hard with medium format film like the 645 format as they are with 35 millimeter. So like a lower-end scanner, like let's say like an Epson V500, it might not do a great job with 35 millimeter, but it does a pretty decent job with the medium format. The first Mamiya 645 camera, the M645, was released in about 1975. It had a focal plane shutter. The shutter speed's up to 1/1500th. The newer model, called the 1000S, added the 1/1000th speed. One limitation of the earlier cameras is they did not have interchangeable film backs, meaning that you couldn't change mid-roll. Let's say you're shooting a slow film and you want to change to a faster film, you would actually have to finish the roll. What they did have, and what wedding photographers liked, and actually it's why I picked this camera today, they were a workhorse staple in the wedding industry trade in the 1980s, is that you had film inserts so that you could load the film onto an insert. And then when you're done one roll, you pop the old insert out and pop the new insert in. And if you combine inserts with a format called 220, which is same size as a 120 roll, but twice the number of pictures, you could go for a while. And of course, if you're shooting a wedding, you can't be wasting time changing film, reloading your camera, because you know, Murphy's Law is that the best shot of the wedding will be taking place when you're changing your film. So if you were a pro, you'd probably have an assistant. You'd be shoot, and his assistant's job basically count the clicks, and as soon as you were done 15, boom, whip off the back of the camera, pull out the old insert, new insert goes in, and back. Your shooting maybe takes 5 seconds to do. The newer models in the 645 series, such as the 645 Pro TL, did have removable backs so that you could swap halfway through a roll of film that go from fast to slow or vice versa, which is really handy. Gives you a lot of flexibility. And one nice thing is that, you know, they have a, whenever you change backs on a camera, you need to have dark, what are called a dark slide, to protect the film. And this camera will not shoot if the dark slide is in the camera, is in the back. So it will prevent you from screwing up. Yeah, and tell me, it's not a good feeling to know you've screwed up.
Now, speaking of the dark slide, if the dark slide's not in, can you remove the back?
There might be an interlock to prevent it.
Okay. Because for a future show, on both my Bronica models, if that slide's not in, you cannot remove the back. That's so good. It does protect.
That might be the case. And we've all worked with some older cameras, like for, let's say, on a view camera. A view camera will cheerfully let you screw up six ways come Sunday. or like a speed graphic. It's up to you to know when to take the dark slide
That's
out.
That's right.
Yep.
So, oh, yeah, I've been there.
Haven't we all?
Eight frames in,
yeah.
Which on a 6x9, that's all of them.
Yeah.
I take the last shot, and that's when I just kind of glance down and I see, oh, look, Mr. Dark Slide is still hiding and nice buried in there. So every frame.
I think if you talk to any film photographer, we all have the same stories. I think film photography has a way of keeping you humble.
Yep.
Yeah.
If you get cocky, the film gods will find a way to make your life miserable. Now, one nice thing about the 6-4-5 line is, and talking about continuity and backwards compatibility, the model here that I have, the 6-4-5 Pro TL, came out about 12 years or so, I think, after the first one, but the lenses are compatible. Even the film inserts are compatible. And one great That's thing awesome. About the Mamiya is the glass. It doesn't get as much press as, let's say, Zeiss, Hasselblad glass, or Leica glass. But the lens quality, I find, is really, really good.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I do agree.
And also, the bang for the buck is, I think, where the Mamiya gear, at least the 6-4-5 gear, really wins. You can go on to eBay and find a lot of their lenses for $100, $150, and these are not dogs. These are good lenses. Mm-hmm. There is one lens. Sadly, I don't have it. I would love to get it. Like I have the normal lens is the 80 millimeter f/2.8. There is an 80 millimeter f/1.9. One of the fastest lenses you can get for this format. It is not a lens that you buy for $100, unfortunately. But I know some people who've tried it, and it's an absolutely amazing lens. Yeah, and you might pay $300, $400 for it, but compared to glass, for some high-end cameras, that's still very reasonable.
Leica?
Yeah, Leica, yes. I'll finish off. And the one thing about the 6-4-5 is you have to get used to the feel of the camera, the ergonomics.
It's not an ergo camera.
No.
No, at least not in every configuration. You can get a combination grip power winder for this camera, which makes it a bit easier to hold. And also advances the film automatically. I just have the hand crank on this one. It is a box. You have to get used to it. But I was able to get used to it. What I would suggest, I think almost for any kind of non-standard camera, if you're thinking of buying one, you can't just go by the pictures. You actually have to hold it in your hand, because we've all run across cameras that take beautiful pictures, but ergonomically we just
can't stand them.
And those cameras become shelf queens.
Yep.
I think that should go basically for any camera in general. I mean, you pick up a camera and you think it's absolutely gorgeous. As soon as you pick it up, all of a sudden it feels like a lead weight in your hands. And it doesn't matter how cheap the camera is. If it just doesn't feel good in your hands, you're not going to use it.
Exactly.
It's just that simple. Yeah.
But I'd say with that proviso, I think you can't go wrong with this format or the Mamiya. No. Great bang for buck.
No, the 640 camera. The 645 is a great format because it maximizes the number of shots you can get. And with 220 film being in rare and rare supply in all the stocks we want, 645, you get 16 or 15 shots on a roll, which is, well, I have a hard time getting through a 20 roll of 35 millimeter these days, so...
Makes I have a hard nice time getting through 12 these days. It's kind of depressing.
Yeah, well.
Now that's what happens when I guess you go 4x5, right?
Exactly. So next up, we have Donna and her little tiny Olympus OM2.
Look at it compared to the T90. I mean, yeah. It's just, it's like a baby camera.
That's what I like about it. The OM2 was introduced in 1975. It's a very light, compact camera with a new automatic exposure system, unlike the manual-only OM1. One of the main selling points of the OM2 was that all of the OM1 accessory and lenses would fit without any kind of modification, which allowed, of course, OM1 users a very easy upgrade. I really like this camera. It's really small. It's cute. It fits in a pocket, a purse, and it's a great overall camera.
Very nice.
Now, one question I have... I know some of the older cameras, you run into issues getting batteries that work, because a lot of the older cameras use mercury cells, which are not available anymore. Do you have to use a mercury cell for this, or can you use a newer battery?
It's a silver oxide batteries,
which are easy to get.
Fantastic.
I believe this one is two LR44s. Okay, so I mean,
nice.
How much easier can you get? Yeah, I mean, the LR44 is everywhere.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
It wouldn't be unheard of. I mean, you open up a remote, probably there's an LR44.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing that I really like about it is the shutter speed dial. Now, a lot of Olympus users, they're used to this. But it's one thing I noticed, like, with my Nikkor mat, is the shutter dial is actually on the lens mount, as opposed to being, say, on a dial. Because I'm a Canon guy, so... Every single Canon I have, speed dials on top. But this one, I'm really impressed. It's right on the mount. And I mean, you've got the shutter speed, and then you've got the aperture ring right after that. I mean, it's just a small movement of your hands. And I mean, someone playing guitar like John or Alex, who likes to do reenactments, I mean, moving your hand just that fraction of an inch just to adjust something else, it would be just like second nature. So, no, you know what? Really, really smart on Olympus to use that option. That's really good.
And the lenses are fantastic as well.
Yes. Yes. I think we can all agree with Leica lenses. Fantastic.
Yeah. Even some of like their cheaper cameras, or like their things like the old like Olympus Trip cult camera.
Yeah.
Olympus XA
35SP.
Yeah. Or the Pen F half frame cameras.
Oh. That thing is the Pen F is wow.
The glass is just, you know,
Alex really is going amazing. Into shivers over a Pen F. So
we'll do that on our half frame episode.
No.
Well, the other thing that I've noticed is if you look here right beside the shutter release, is you have an exposure compensation dial. You got +1 through to +2, and then -1 through -2. Nice. So whatever the ISO setting you set on this camera, you mean you can go down to, what is it on here, 32 ISO, which isn't bad. I mean, that's fairly low. Usually most cameras I see go down to about 25, but 32 is not bad. But I mean, you go down -1, -2, now you're exposing below 25. So what difference does that make on how low it goes? But that's really good. I really like this. So
yeah,
the fact that you get ISO 32, Alex's wonderful little Panatomic X trip is load some T-Max 100
and shoot it at
32 and develop it
in X-Tol.
There's a little wonderful darkroom tip right there. Get a Panatomic X look for those that really like Panatomic X. And
absolutely.
I absolutely love Panatomic X. Yeah. What a brilliant film.
Mm-hmm.
Sad on Kodak, but you can't keep them all going.
Absolutely. Okay, so next we have the beast of a 35mm camera, the Nikon F4. Now, this is my pick simply because it's the camera I will always grab. It's come with me on pretty much every trip I've been to, Ottawa, Texas, all the way down to Tennessee. Well, I mean, Texas is further, but everyone knows that as soon as I cross the border into Texas, my little Cavalier turns into a pickup truck, but everything's bigger in Texas. The F4 is the fourth iteration of the Nikon Professional line.
And speaking of which, look what John just brought out.
Hey, it's a Nikon F4. The camera was released in 1988. Unfortunately, it only had a very short run compared to its predecessor, the F3. It only ran until 97 when they introduced the Nikon F5. This is truly the first camera that introduced the look and feel of a professional single-lens reflex camera. It's autofocus, which I'll get to that later. It has a huge range of ISO, always all the way down to 6, all the way up to 6400.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Incredibly quiet. Again, you got from a -2 to a +2 on exposure bias. And incredibly, incredibly quiet shutter and motor drive. In fact, it was so quiet that models would complain that they couldn't hear the click to know when they had to change poses. Flash sync speed of 1/250th of a second. Now, like any camera, there are some problems. The autofocus. This was the second attempt at Nikon to produce an autofocus camera, and the one that actually stuck for a while, because the autofocus is actually built into the camera body, not into the lens.
At least it's not a T80. But that'll be future.
This was to maintain backwards compatibility. The Nikon mount, since its inception with the Nikon F, hasn't really changed much. Even modern digital SLRs from Nikon use the F mount. You can use everything from non-AI glass all the way up to modern AFS That's lenses. Cool. The only trouble is, once you lose the aperture ring with the G-type glass, you're stuck with shutter priority mode and manual mode, and full program mode. Which, of course, for me, who shoots a lot in dark environments like abandoned buildings, the shutter speed dial only goes down to 4 seconds, which isn't a lot. Then I'm stuck using bulb and time mode and manually counting it off in my head or using a phone as a timer. But other than that, this is my camera that I use for street photography. I pair it with a 105mm lens, and even with the general feel and overall presence of the camera in the hand, the quiet shutter speed really helps keep people, not so much, looking at the camera. Plus, it's modular, so you can swap out the battery grip and turn your F4 into the even bigger F4E, or the midsize F4S. You can swap out the prism to have a look down, or smaller, or everything. The metering system is fantastic. In fact, Nikon's metering technology started with the F4, and the FG has center-weighted, spot, and matrix, which is average. And probably my favorite part about the camera, it takes AA batteries.
That's cool.
You can be up in Cobalt, Ontario, and get batteries for your camera if it runs out. Cobalt, Ontario, for those who don't know, is about 6 hours north of Toronto, where we are right now, and there's no franchises there. Don't expect a Tim Hortons or a McDonald's.
It's true.
You'll find a liquor store and a couple of restaurants.
No Tim Hortons, are you sure it's in Canada? Doesn't that violate the law?
I think so, but that's not our position.
Now, just curious on the F4. That's one thing that I've noticed some cameras have, other ones don't. Does it have the viewfinder blind? So if you're doing,
yes.
It does have.
Yes, okay. It does.
Because that is one thing that I noticed on the T90 I brought, is the viewfinder blind.
Yep.
That, I think, is really awesome for, look at that, even the John's Mamiya Pro TL has a blind. I really like that for long exposure, just for the fact that I've done a couple long exposures, and I did it, of course, on an AE-1, and the one thing that a lot of people end up losing is the little black clap to go over the viewfinder. Yes. To block it out from any kind of light leaking in. And you know what? I hate to say it, but yes, light does leak in. I've had it happen to me. I couldn't believe
absolutely.
It.
If you're doing long exposures, especially astrophotography, yep. You really need to keep that viewfinder closed up.
Yeah, I was really surprised. So when I happened to get my hands on this camera and it had the viewfinder blind, I thought that was just a fantastic feature. So
I think it's a pro camera. Every feature that you'd want
is there.
Is going to be there.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you're looking through the viewfinder, what kind of coverage are you getting for
100%.
100%?
That's been one of the defining characteristics of the Nikon F. It was always 100%,
yeah.
End of discussion.
That's whereas, really like, you know,
the the more consumer-grade SLRs from various manufacturers would be 80, 85,
mm-hmm.
Perhaps 90.
Yeah, but I think the T90 is around 90, 95%. I mean, it's better than what you expect from some SLRs, but 100%, that's fantastic. I mean, the only other camera I've ever used with 100% is an old Praktika, or even a Zenit I used had 100% coverage. But I mean, it was really bad when, I mean, you can see the housing around the focus screen. But hey, I mean, it's a Zenit. What more do you want?
One thing I throw in about the Nikon F4, because I got mine last year, and like on the used market, these are not expensive.
No, they're not.
You know, if you're patient, wait for a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can not much, like around the $200 mark.
Exactly. And again, probably because they were so short-lived, and most people were still running an F3 and then jumped right up to the F5.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Right?
I'm wondering, the F5, is that another, like, similar plastic-style body, or...
You know the EOS 1 series?
Yes. Yeah, the magnesium body.
The two are the same.
Oh, okay.
It's essentially the same. That is they were really... I mean, the F4 started it, but when the F5 came along, that became the platform of all professional... Okay. SLRs, even up into their digital ranges today. So
okay. I was wondering
the D1, the D2, the D3, and the D4.
Yeah, I was wondering if that played a role in the price being a bit lower, being a non-metal camera. Because I know...
Oh, this thing's metal. You could kill a man with this camera.
Oh, it looks like it. It looks like it. Because I know the T90, when you're comparing it to its direct competition for professional cameras was the Canon F1. The Canon F1 still, it fetches a price.
Yes.
A really, really darn good price.
Oh, yes.
They're saying, like, the F4 is a bargain. Also, if I can bring it up, it's one other camera that I think is similar in a lot of respects to the F4 is the Nikon N90 or N90S. Sometimes the F90.
F90, yep.
Depends which country released it.
We're in Canada, so it's the F90.
I really like my F90.
And the thing about that is, like, those cameras are almost disposable. I've seen the bodies for sale for $30. So if you're on the fence, you want to try it out, what I recommend, buy a Nikon F90S body for about $30. Get a 50mm Series E 1.8 lens.
I have that lens.
Great lens. And, you know, if you shop around, you'll be under $100.
And be rocking it out.
And then if you really like it, then welcome to the world of Nikon. How much money did you bring?
That's right.
Well, it's funny, speaking of really underpriced bodies, I mean, my F90, I know a lot of people probably hate me for this, is... I went to that wonderful little outlet store that a lot of us camera photographers and film photographers in Toronto know.
Henry's?
Just in Mississauga, the Henry's Outlet Store.
Henry's Outlet Store.
And these guys, I think sometimes they're absolutely crazy, because I walked in and sitting there on a table, all priced at $5. Yes, you're hearing me, $5. I saw the Nikon F90 just sitting there, and I thought, why not? I've got nothing to lose. I've got my Nikkor mat, so I've got the Nikkor E series 50mm. Got a Tokina 28 that John wonderfully sold me, and I also had a Sigma 75-200 lens, which is just phenomenal. I got that one for free because it doesn't work properly, the autofocus and the aperture, but since it's got an aperture ring, big deal. It'll stop down on the F90.
Yep.
I just can't use autofocus, but that's not an issue. And $5 for the camera, and hey, into the world of Nikon you go, and yeah, you know what? I really mm-hmm. do like that camera.
When it was new, it was $1,000.
It's wow. It's unreal. Unreal, the change.
Absolutely. Well, the one thing that we're dealing with here in Toronto these days is labs are closing.
Or right? stopping certain
lines. Or stopping service. So the nice thing is, today, it's really easy to develop film at home. Not just black and white. You can do color C41 and color E6 at home with about the same steps, same equipment that you use for your black and white.
We should specify C41, if you don't know, is color negative film.
It's
and
also
E6 is slide.
Yeah.
There's also black and white C41.
Yeah. The for those that have seen it on canisters by Fuji, CN16, that's color negative. It's just the Fuji's processing designation that they gave color negative film. It is exactly the same as Kodak C41 process.
Yeah, exactly. So if someone's just brand new into this, what's the basic equipment that they're going to need to get started?
Development tanks, absolutely.
Number one. More specifically, it's a daylight tank.
Yes.
Which means that once you have the film loaded into it, it's light tight.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's how film works. It's exposed to light. But you don't want to rip it out of its canister and pull it off the paper you're effed. So really the first thing you need is
a hole that you can do that with, though.
Is a space to load the film. Now, if you're in your house and you're doing it in, like, your kitchen, your laundry room, your dining room.
I do it at my dining room.
You need a light tight space to do it in. So you're first going to obviously need either if you're lucky and have a lab nearby that is closing and has one, a dark box, which is essentially a light tight box with two arms that you can reach in and manipulate the film inside. And that gives you a lot of real estate. But unfortunately, you can't always nab those before the lab closes, so you're forced to use what's called a change bag. Now, the problem with change bags, they're black. It gets really hot in the summer, and you start to sweat. My solution is I've started wearing latex mechanics gloves or first aid gloves that are powderless. Now, Mike brought up an interesting trick to use.
I can't remember who it is that told me this, but I was reading on, I believe it was a Flickr forum, and one of the things that was mentioned was use a box inside your change bag. A lot of people, we've done it. We put your hands in the change bag, and for those that don't like to use gloves, I don't like using gloves. I feel they're constraining on my hands. So I put my hands in the bag. I've got my hands in there for a few minutes, and certain films, no problem, get them loaded on the reels, and it's just simple. But you do get those certain films that no matter what you do, they are just there to thwart you. They want to cause you pain. So I've had a few of those, and I'm sure we all have, but one of the things that I found was put a box in there. I never thought of it. As soon as I read it, I thought, no, that really can't make that much of a difference. So what I did is I got a box that I could easily fit my reel in, whether it's stainless or plastic. That's a completely other topic that you can argue on for years on. And once you have it that you can fit your tank off to the side, but your reel in with your film, and if you're doing 35, a small pair of scissors, it'll make a world of difference. You have so much more room, and the bag is not collapsing in on you. And mm-hmm. you know what? Mm-hmm. Film sweats, they're gone. It's just a breeze, unless you get those rolls of film that just don't like you.
Polyester base.
Yeah. and speaking of sweating, whether you get a steel reel tank or a plastic reel tank, and they have their pluses and minuses, regardless of what you get, it's important to practice. It's because you'll be doing it in the dark. And like what I would recommend is when you buy the tank or you acquire a developing tank, take a roll of film, you know, a trash, like a sacrificial lamb, and mm-hmm. practice loading the reel in the light so you can watch what you're doing. Did it the first time? Great. Do it again. Do it 50 times. Do it while you're watching TV. You have to get to a point where you can do it blindfolded, because literally in a dark room, that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
I can't stress that more. When I first started out, I was using plastic and I went to stainless steel, and everybody who's ever used stainless steel knows this happens. Got a little bit cocky, loaded up the film, thought everything was fine, take the film out, after fixing and washing, and that's when you found the film buckled. And you've got the emulsion touching in several spots. You take it out, and your film that you have, everything just becomes high-speed aerial as it goes flying across the room. And believe me, as John said, practice, practice, practice. You can't practice enough. Yep. And one of the things that I find, if you want to use stainless, is very lightly use your fingers on the inside as you go around coil by coil. Use your fingers. Just feel it. Is it buckled? If it is, unwind it. Try again.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to have, especially if these are really important shots, you don't want the film to buckle. It sucks. I've been there. I hate it.
Like that picture you took of Elvis proving he was still alive, but the film buckled?
Well, no, actually that day was the one that the film didn't grab in the camera, and I missed all my Pulitzer prizes on that one. Just... Yeah. Everybody, it's fantastic. When we do
our episode, we'll bring that up.
As the gang here has been mentioning, there are two types of daylight tanks out there. There's stainless steel, and there's plastic. Go with what you know. Go with what you like. Like anything, use what you know.
Everybody has their preference.
Everyone has their preferences here. I mean, we could fight for hours on which is better. The thing with plastic, make sure it's bone dry before you use it.
Hairdryer.
Hair dryer works. Or, I mean, I have five reels, so I can either develop five at a time, or I cycle them out. The one that I used first will be nice and dry by the time I need to use it again. So, once you have your film loaded, it's in the tank, you're going to need three main chemicals to develop your film. You're going to need a developer, you're going to need, well, this is for black and white, a developer, a stop bath, and a fixer.
And of course, to put these in, you need measuring cups.
Exactly. And these can really be anything, right?
That's right.
What you can find in your kitchen will work too, as long as it's graduated and you know how much chemistry is needed to fill your tank.
Just don't use the same items that you're using for chemicals.
Back in your kitchen again.
Yeah, in your brownies. Because those brownies, they're going to be some pretty funky brownies.
This is a one-way street.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you can probably get them on the cheap from something like the dollar store. Right.
My cousin, he just got into black and white developing, and pretty much everything he got
was from the dollar store.
Dollar store, exactly. Now, the thing with stop baths, that there's two methods.
I agree.
Yeah. I'm a water stop bath.
Water stop, yep. Yep.
Or you can use a chemical stop bath. I keep chemical stop baths on hand if I'm using particularly strong developers, like if I'm using Kodak D76 Xtol or Microdol X in their stock form, I'll use a chemical stop.
I have to be a bit careful with chemical stop baths. Donna, she's really sensitive. I had some Kodak indicator stop that I had mixed up.
Okay.
And it actually got on, I don't know what exactly happened, got on her hands. Ooh. And
I completely burned.
And on her arm.
And burn.
It was like she had a chemical burn.
It was really bad.
This is dilute. So we're not talking about full strength from the bottle. And this is only acetic acid.
Yeah.
And so what I don't understand is, since it's acetic acid, vinegar, why it happened. Now, my only thinking is that possibly it was a combination between the acetic acid and the indicator in it that caused it. So, possibly. Because I know if she sticks her hand in vinegar, nothing. Nothing happens other than you smell like French fries.
Yeah. And, of course, the final step is fixer. And, again, Ilford has their rapid fixer, which you mix up.
I'm a Cotafix guy.
I'm Cotafix as well, mostly because I just use it straight out of the bottle. In, shake it around, pour it back into the jug.
Yep.
Good to go.
Now, at the very end, there's also the option to hypoclear, which is basically it's a chemistry that is designed to lessen the amount of fixer that's on the film and shorten your washing time. And then, of course, finally, during washing, there's PhotoFlow or other rinse aid, which helps your film dry clean.
And like Ilford's PermaWash.
PermaWash.
PhotoSpeed.
PhotoFlow.
Yeah, the Kodak PhotoFlow, yeah.
And I think the importance of removing the fixer from the film cannot be overestimated. Yes. If you know, either use the HypoClear or just longer washing time, or things like the Ilford washing method are great, because what'll happen is if you don't clear the fixtures in your film properly, it'll look fine today, it'll look fine tomorrow, but you come back in a couple of months' time and your negatives will be discoloring and staining, because that fixture will start eating away like a cancer at your images. So
yeah. I've got some brown negatives.
Yeah, so fixture
had.
You can't do photography without fixture, but boy, it's a double-edged sword. You have to be patient and do what it takes to get rid of it. Otherwise, you will not be happy.
For those that are wondering, Fix is not toxic. I mean, you can literally, if you had a bottle fixer, you could go out and you can fertilize your garden with it. So no, it's perfectly safe. The problem is the silver, since it does dissolve the silver. That's the only part where it now is toxic, but not for humans, which is very strange. Large animals, silver is not a problem, but aquatic animals, stuff like that, very sensitive to That's silver. Right. Don't dump it down the drain. That's right. Your household hazardous waste depot, drop it off, label it silver content. That's They'll right. take care of it.
What I like to do is I get empty bottles of windshield washer fluid, so that I'm not handing over my good jug
That's
right. to yeah. hazardous waste.
Smart way to do it.
And I drop in just a bit of steel wool. And the steel wool will suck up the silver. And the liquid can be poured off. And I just collect the sludge in a little margarine container. And then I just hand them the margarine container after several years.
That's a good idea.
Well, silver reclamation. I mean, you're not going to get rich off it, so.
Especially not in a home developing situation.
No, yeah.
And again, the equipment we've listed here can also be used for color developing, but most important for color developing is get a thermometer. Get a good dial thermometer, because you need a lot more temperature control with color than you do with black and white. Black and white, you're looking at a plus minus 1 degree Celsius. I'm usually plus minus 1.5 degrees. But with black and white film, you have that level of latitude. But the important thing is to maintain some level of consistency with your temperatures. With color, follow the instructions. Yeah. Always.
To the letter. When they say plus or minus 1.5 degree, they mean plus or minus 1.5 degree. This is one area I think where stainless steel tanks have an advantage over plastic.
Yes. Is that
stainless steel, they don't insulate temperature the way that plastic does. You can have a water tempering bath to maintain the temperature of that, and between agitations you put your steel reel and the daylight tank in there, and it really helps maintain the temperature. And even for black and white, they're saying even though you have a bit more latitude, it is crucial to keep the temperature, let's say your developer, same temperature as your fixer, same temperature as the water stop bath, same temperature as the water rinse, because if you get wild fluctuations in temperature, you will get increased apparent grain in the negative.
That's right.
Or another wonderful thing called reticulation.
Reticulation.
Yes. Yep. Or it's almost like a cracking through the emulsion.
Yeah. That's if you like reticulation, that's where you go, let's say, ice water to under boiling.
Yes.
But even, the enhanced graininess is almost like a mild form of reticulation.
Yeah, it's an enhanced graininess. Depending on the film, I mean, you can use that to your advantage, or it can really ruin a film.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed is one of the reasons why I don't really try to use HP5 in 35mm. It's a grainy film. I mean, I've seen people referring to it as a 1970s Tri-X. And in all honesty, I'd gladly agree with that. It does have the grain. I mean, but change it up into 120 or larger, and it becomes a whole new film. And you know what? HP5 is absolutely gorgeous.
Fantastic. Well, that's it for this show. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook, Classic Camera Revival. Please do like us. And you can also send us an email. We're at classiccamerarevival@gmail.com. That's it for us. Join us again. We'll be back at the last Friday of February. Have a good night, all.
Keep shooting.
Keep those shutters firing.